Welcome back to The Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today we're talking about Part 3, Chapter 3, read by the lovely Div Derivic. I had a listen to it, and it was a boring chapter. And I don't say it's not anything to do with your reading, Nifty. Your reading was perfect. It was just a boring chapter. Thank you to the people who said a little congratulations to me for winning that short story competition. Only a little competition. It's no big deal, but still. Thanks very much, guys. Swim said the mama fishy said, I believe the appropriate expression is good on you. Good on ya. The only thing I know of Bogans I've learned from the Howzo's TV series. concerning my age, and as an enlightened 21st century woman who should thoroughly disapprove of this Oscar Wilde quote, one should never trust a woman who tells one her real age. A woman who would tell one that would tell one anything. Fair enough. Swim said the mama fishy also said this. Good Lord, could Sergei be any more condescending? And Levin's what's in it for me ethos is irritating. I had to keep telling myself that he's just responding to Sergei's needling in the worst way possible. He knows from personal experience that the Zemstov isn't working and is realistically useless. Since Levin is often considered a stand-in for Tolstoy, I was puzzled that Levin was against education of the peasants, especially considering that Tolstoy had a school on his estate for several years. It sent me nosing around the internet, tidbits that cleared it up for me. Tolstoy thought that the elementary schools of his time were just too removed from real life and not sufficiently focused on specific life callings. It was as if children were taught nothing and everything at the same time, which often resulted in superficial and incomplete knowledge. It is amazing to see how innovative Tolstoy's ideas are. Over a century ago, he spoke about the importance of educating children for actual life instead of presenting them with an overwhelming amount of information that they will never use. Levin gives his main reason for not caring about the common cause. Why should he build schools that neither he nor his children will ever use, and that the peasants don't want to attend? Not only do peasants not want to bother with education, but schooling makes them useless for their actual jobs. Wow. What a time to be alive, hey? I am a Norwegian, said congratulations on winning, and thank you, Norwegian, much appreciated. I was surprised to see Levin take the rational, egoist-like stance here, but I don't think we're getting Levin's actual views, which I think is something more like disillusionment. Arguing a disillusioned stance is to an idealist is very difficult. Sorry. Arguing a disillusioned stance... Arguing a disillusioned stance to an idealist is very difficult. I really liked this chapter. I felt exactly like Levin at the end of verbal casual arguments with friends and my own brother. One of the reasons why I prefer to have those conversations through text. Atomic Gecko 7 said, if William Goldman, the good parts of the Princess Bride book, ever abridges Anna Karenina, I'd bet he'd leave out these first few... three chapters of part three. J-Mama 8779 says, I'll admit I completely zoned out during this chapter. I did a bit too. Nifty-rific says, it was dreadfully boring. The bros were random debating, and Levin's older brother is sort of pushing Levin's buttons, and when Levin doesn't just concede, his brother takes the conversation to a place where Levin can't follow. And I thought they were still fishing, but maybe they were riding horses. Yawn fest. The only thing I really got out of it is just another expression of Levin's emotional immaturity. He gets a little flustered and passionate. Jan Brunt said, isn't it interesting that Levin and Steve were classmates? Levin seems so young, and Steve seems squarely in the middle age. I think they are both in their early 30s at this point. It doesn't help that Dolly is described as elderly by Steve. At the ripe old age of 28. That's insane. Surely no one who was 28 was considered elderly back then, right? That's... Oh my God, what a time. What a time. How would it be if you just were, like, life, what you were expected to live for about 30, 40 years, and that's it. Crazy. Alright. That's it for the conversation of today. Oh man, my brain's not working. I've had band practice tonight. Band practice. And oh God, it's tiring. It's fun, but it really drains you. Got a gig tomorrow night, so we're getting ready for that. Golly. Yeah, so I'm really tired. My brain's not working, so I'm very glad to say we have a guest reading again today from Nifty Riffic. Thank you, Nifty Riffic, for filling in again with the reading. I think we've got another guest coming along to do a reading in the coming days. I'm not sure if that's still happening, but I hope so. And if anyone out there listening would like to do some reading, just hit me up. Send me a message through Reddit, and we'll sort it out and we'll get you to read a chapter or two. All right, please enjoy Nifty Riffic's reading of Part 3, Chapter 4. I'll see you tomorrow.
Hey y'all, this is Nifty Riffic bringing you some dulcet tones. I quite like that compliment, by the way. It makes me feel nice. I think the reading of Chapter 3 was a disaster. These dialogue-rich chapters kind of are super difficult for me to read because I feel like I should be more of an actor. Like, I should assign them specific voices to differentiate amongst them in conversation, because, you know, these sentences don't always end with Koznishev said or replied or Levin said or replied. And I think I'm a little too self-conscious to assign voices to them. And I read it super fast, and I'm sorry, I think because I just wasn't that into it. I'm going to try to do better this time with Chapter 4. Chapter 4. The personal matter that occupied Levin while he was talking with his brother was this. The year before, when visiting a field that was being mown, he had lost his temper with the steward, and to calm himself had used a remedy of his own. He took a scythe from one of the peasants and himself began mowing. He liked this work so much that he went mowing several times. He mowed all the meadow in front of his house, and when spring came he planned to devote several whole days to mowing with the peasants. Since his brother's arrival, however, he was in doubt whether to go mowing or not. He did not feel comfortable at the thought of leaving his brother alone all day, and he also feared that Koznishev might laugh at him. But while walking over the meadow, he recalled the impression mowing had made on him, and almost made up his mind to do it. After his irritating conversation with his brother, he again remembered his intention. "I need physical exercise. Without it, my character gets quite spoiled," thought he, and determined to go and mow, however uncomfortable his brother and the peasants might make him feel. In the evening, Konstantin went to the office and gave orders about the work, sending round to the villages to tell the mowers to come next day to the Kalina meadow, the largest and finest he had. "And please send my scythe to Titus to be sharpened and have it taken to the meadow tomorrow. I may go mowing myself," he said, trying to overcome his confusion. The steward smiled and said, "All right, sir." That evening at tea, Levin said to his brother, "The weather looks settled. Tomorrow we begin mowing." "I like that work very much," said Koznishev. "I like it awfully, too. I have mown with the peasants now and then, and tomorrow I want to mow all day." Koznishev looked up at his brother in surprise. "How do you mean, all day, just like the peasants?" "Yes, it is very pleasant," replied Levin. "It is splendid physical exercise, but you will hardly be able to hold out," remarked Koznishev without the least sarcasm. "I have tried it. At first it seems hard, but one gets drawn into it. I don't think I shall lag behind." "Dear me, but tell me, how do the peasants take it? I expect they laugh at their crank of a master." "No, I don't think so, but it is such pleasant work, and at the same time so hard that one has no time for thinking." "But how can you dine with them? It would not be quite the thing to send your claret and roast turkey out there." "No, I will just come home at their dinner time." Next morning, Konstantin got up earlier than usual, but giving instructions about the farming delayed him, and when he came to the meadow, each man was already mowing his second swath. From the hill, as he came to his first swath, he could see in the shade at his feet a part of the meadow that was already mown, with the green heaps of grass and dark piles of coats thrown down by the mowers. As he drew nearer, the peasants, following each other in a long, straggling line, some with coats on, some in their shirts, each swinging his scythe in his own manner, gradually came into sight. He counted 42 of them. They moved slowly along the uneven bottom of the meadow where a weir had once been. Levin recognized some of his own men. Old Ermel, wearing a very long white shirt, was swinging his scythe with his back bent. Young Vaska, who had been in Levin's service as a coachman, and who at each swing of his scythe cut the grass the whole width of his swath. And Titus, Levin's mowing master, a thin little peasant, who went along without stopping, mowing his wide swath as if in play. Levin dismounted and, tethering his horse by the roadside, went up to Titus, who fetched another scythe from behind a bush and gave it to Levin. "It's ready, master, like a razor. It will mow of itself," said Titus, taking off his cap and smiling as he handed the scythe. Levin took it and began to put himself in position. The peasants, perspiring and merry, who had finished their swaths, came out on the road one after another and laughingly exchanged greetings with their master. They all looked at him, but no one made any remark until a tall old man with a shriveled, beardless face, wearing a sheepskin jacket, stepped out onto the road and addressed him. "Mind, master, having put your hand to the plow, don't look back." And Levin heard the sound of repressed laughter among the mowers. "I will try not to lag behind," he said, taking his place behind Titus and waiting his turn to fall in. "Mine," repeated the old man. Titus made room for Levin, and Levin followed him. By the roadside, the grass was short and tough, and Levin, who had not done any mowing for a long time and was confused by so many eyes upon him, mowed badly for the first 10 minutes, though he swung his scythe with much vigor. He heard voices behind him. "It's not properly adjusted. The grip is not right. See how he has to stoop," said one. "Hold the heel lower," said another. "Never mind. It's all right. He'll get into it," said the old man. "There he goes. You are taking too wide a swath. You'll get knocked up. He's the master. He must work. He's working for himself. But look how uneven. That's what the likes of us used to get a thump on the back for." They came to softer grass, and Levin, who was listening without replying, followed Titus and tried to mow as well as possible. When they had gone some 100 steps, Titus was still going on without pausing, showing no signs of fatigue, while Levin was already beginning to fear he would not be able to keep up. He felt so tired. He swung his scythe, feeling almost at the last gasp, and made up his mind to ask Titus to stop. But just at that moment, Titus stopped of his own accord, stooped, took up some grass, and wiped his scythe with it. Levin straightened himself, sighed, and looked back. The peasant behind him was still mowing, but was obviously tired too, for he stopped without coming even with Levin and began wetting his scythe. Titus wetted his own and Levin's, and they began mowing again. The same thing happened at Levin's second attempt. Titus swung his scythe, swing after swing, without stopping and without getting tired. Levin followed, trying not to lag behind, but it became harder and harder until at last the moment came when he felt he had no strength left, and then Titus again stopped and began wetting his scythe. In this way they finished the swaths. They were long, and to Levin seemed particularly difficult, but when it was done and Titus, with his scythe over his shoulder, turned about and slowly retraced his steps, placing his feet on the marks left on the mown surface by the heels of his boots, and Levin went down his own swath in the same way, then in spite of the perspiration that ran down his face in streams and dripped from his nose, and though his back was as wet as if the shirt had been soaked in water, he felt very light-hearted. What gave him most pleasure was the knowledge that he would be able to keep up with the peasants. The only thing marring his joy was the fact that his swath was not well mown. "I must swing the scythe less with my arms and more with the whole of my body," he thought, comparing Titus's swath, cut straight as if by measure, with his own, on which the grass lay scattered and uneven. As Levin was aware, Titus had been mowing his swath with special rapidity, probably to put his master to the test, and it chanced to be a very long one. The next swaths were easier, but still Levin had to work with all his might to keep even with the peasants. He thought of nothing and desired nothing, except not to lag behind and to do his work as well as possible. He heard only the swishing of the scythes and only saw the receding figure of Titus, the convex half-circle of the mown piece before him, and the grasses and heads of flowers falling in waves about the blade of his scythe, and in the background the end of the swath where he would rest. Suddenly he was conscious of a pleasant coolness on his hot, perspiring shoulders. Without knowing what it was or whence it came, he glanced up at the sky whilst whetting his scythe. Try to say that three times fast. With whetting his scythe. A dark cloud was hanging low overhead, and large drops of rain were falling. Some of the peasants went to put on their coats. Others, as well as Levin, felt pleasure in the refreshing rain and merely moved their shoulders up and down. They came to the end of another swath. They went on mowing long and short rows, good and poor grass. Levin had lost count of time and had really no idea whether it was late or early. His work was undergoing a change which gave him intense pleasure. While working, he sometimes forgot for some minutes what he was about and felt quite at ease. Then his mowing was nearly as even as that of Titus, but as soon as he began thinking about it and trying to work better, he at once felt how hard the task was and mowed badly. He finished a swath and was about to start another when Titus paused and went up to the old man, and both looked at the sun. What are they talking about, and why don't they start another swath? Thought Levin. It did not occur to him that the peasants, who had been mowing unceasingly for 4 hours, wanted their breakfast. Breakfast time, master, said the old man. Is it time? Well, then breakfast. Levin handed his scythe to Titus, and with the peasants, who were going to fetch the bread that lay with their coats, went across the swaths to the long mown portion of the meadow, slightly sprinkled with rain. Only then he remembered that he had not been right about the weather, and that the rain was wetting the hay. The hay will be spoiled, said he. It won't hurt, master. Mow in the rain, rake when it's fine. Levin untied his horse and rode home to his coffee. By the time Levin had finished breakfast, Koznishev had only just got up, and Levin went back to the meadow before Koznishev had come to table. And that's chapter 4. Full of words like wet and scythe. And swaths. Oh, and by the way, let's see, we are 33% of the book done. Scythe in that chapter was said 19 times, and swath was said 17 times. Just so you know.